It is a particular pleasure for me to have the opportunity this afternoon to introduce our first speaker. I am filling in for Phil, who is indisposed today. I know that a good introducer, you know, will always get a little background on a speaker and try to fill you in on them so they won't have to themselves. I had dinner with Betty and Jack and Rita last night, so I was going to get some of this background information, you know, and wound up not getting a whole lot. And I got to think about this morning. I remember that I was on the program with the intergroup in Toledo one year, and Chuck Webb and some of the fellows had invited me, and I got there, and a pretty young lady was the chairman who was going to introduce me, and she made it a point to go have a cup of coffee with me and get all the background information before she introduced me. Then when she got ready to introduce me, she said, "Some of us have heard Lowell before, and some of us have not. Those of us who have not are looking forward to hearing him now." So I have to be a little bit careful even if I didn't get all my correct background information on Betty. I do know that she's a native of the New York area, and from the way she talked last night, I think she could be induced to move real easily. I believe it's been some 16 or 17 years since she's visited in Columbus, and it's our delight to have her here. I don't think that I have ever had the opportunity to meet a group of more dedicated people than the staff at the General Service Office. I know you couldn't buy that sort of dedication. It has to be there, and she's one of them. And, you know, to have the tolerance to put up with us drunks and answer our letters tactfully and handle all the assignments that they have takes something out of an extraordinary person. Now, Betty now, her assignment is, she was telling us, is the World Service Conference, which is coming up in October, and she's worried to death about it. She can just imagine losing a Belgian, you know, in the subway somewhere. And that could probably happen in New York real easy. So it's a real pleasure for me to have the opportunity to introduce to you from the General Service Office in New York, Betty L.
Thank you very much, Lowell. My name is Betty Little, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Betty.
Hi. I was amused at Lowell's story about those of you who've heard me before. And there's one lady who came from Indianapolis, because she's going to take me home with her tomorrow. And she's a friend of mine from Long Island AA, and that's where I came into AA in 1963. And she's heard me more than once. But and I wanted to tell her she could leave now if she wanted to. However, I'm kind of glad she's here because it's going to keep me honest anyhow. I am a member today of the contact group that meets in Mustard Seed on 37th Street in Manhattan. And I came into Manhattan in 1971, and as a result of my being there and of my having some friends and of God's will, I think, I became a member of the General Service Office staff. And for me, that's probably the greatest privilege I've ever had in my life. I'd like to tell you first a little bit about my own experiences at GSO. You know, we talked this morning about the AA group and how to make it better. And I think those of us who live in metropolitan areas have a tendency to take our groups for granted and to take the fact that there is an AA group and a meeting every night for granted. And the first assignment I was given at GSO made me aware of something that I was taking for granted and of its enormous value, because I'd worked on the loaner assignment. And I corresponded with people all over the world and in the United States in isolated areas who didn't have AA groups and who had to stay sober on their own. And I met, as a matter of fact, at one of the General Service conferences, a man from, I think it was Salina, Virginia. And he was sober many, many years, and he talked about the time that he was alone in Salina. And he put an ad in the paper about an AA group would meet on Thursdays, and he'd go down there Thursday night at 8 o'clock, and for more than a year he sat there by himself and read the big book. And finally one night a couple came in, and a group was started in Salina. Now there are people today in Montana one in particular who works in a ranch of some kind, and the only way you can get there is helicopter. And they correspond with our office and receive the bi-monthly loaner's bulletin, which is a meeting by mail. And there are other AA members who do have our advantages of groups who correspond with them and act as loaner sponsors. And I thought, and I think today, it was a marvelous way to begin my work at the General Service Office. Because I learned what they did. They make 12-step work possible. And that's the main thrust of our work there, is to make 12-step work possible. Whether it's through providing services to your committees, like your PI committee, your institutions committee. We make it possible. We try and help you to bring the message to people in these various places, in jails, in hospitals, to your general public, by providing you with materials that you can bring into the institutions or to the newspapers. A loaner service tries to help the loaner get in contact with the AA, who has the advantage of an AA group. And after I had finished with that, I worked on the International Convention in Denver. I worked on the Trustees Nominating Committee, which has to do with our service structure and its procedures. And then in 1974, I was asked, and I accepted in about 30 seconds, to go to London, England, to help Juanita New work on the Third World Service Meeting, which took place in London. That's what I'm doing now, is working on the World Service Meeting, which will be in New York this year. It takes place every other year, and every other meeting is held outside of the United States. The fifth one, which will be in 1978, will be held either in Finland or in Mexico. Both of them are bidding for the fifth World Service Meeting. And if you can consider our General Service Conference as sort of the Senate of AA, the only body that can make decisions for AA as a whole in this country and in Canada, you could then liken the World Service Meeting to the UN of AA, because members of their boards and their service offices come together every other year to share just the kind of thing that we're sharing here today, because their AA groups and their AA structure are younger than ours, and they're running into the same problems. It's amazing. The language doesn't make a bit of difference. When I was in London, Argentina was seated for the first time at the World Service Meeting, and their report was given verbally. And a beautiful Argentinian woman stood up, and she told the story of AA in Argentina. And she spoke of the sobriety of Hector, who was the other delegate, and he was there in the room. And some 20 years before, Hector was dying of alcoholism in Argentina. And his doctor said to him, "Hector, there's nothing more that I can do for you, and I don't know who can." But he said, "I've read of some people in New York, and I have their address, and maybe they can help you. Here it is, and write to them." And so indeed, Hector did write, and Ann McFarland, some of you I'm sure knew Ann, who served at the General Service Office for 27 years, answered Hector's letter. That was, I guess, some 20 years before. And AA was being seated that day, because Hector was the first loaner in Argentina, and it was being seated that day at the World Service Meeting in London. Hector stopped. Argentina, incidentally, recognizes the anniversary of their AA as the date that letter arrived at Hector's home. And so you see, everything that we do for you, through your support, is in the interest of all of our primary purpose, and that's to carry the message to the alcoholic who still suffers. I'm also assigned, and I wanted to tell you a little bit today, about our next international convention in New Orleans. How many of you were in Denver? Well, that's good. I'm sure that you know what a thrilling and exciting experience it was to be at an AA meeting with something like 19,000 people. We were in New Orleans in June. I have been assigned to be the secretary of the New Orleans Convention. And we went down on a group of us called the Site Inspection Committee. The Site Selection Committee chose New Orleans in April, and then this inspection committee was assigned to go to New Orleans and see that all the facilities were available and that they were able to handle us. And they indeed are. It's an exciting city. The Superdome has fantastic facilities. We were taken into the main arena of the Superdome, and shown a configuration where we can seat 30,000 people in one room with good acoustics and with a closed-circuit television right in the room, so that if you're so far up that the people look small on the stage, you can see an enlarged version of what's on the stage on this television, which is suspended from the ceiling. It's an exciting city. It has a lot of cultural things to do. The French Quarter is still there and is swinging, and there's a lot of jazz music. And the AA people in New Orleans, we met with them the night before we came home, and they're all looking for you to come. So save your Confederate money and be with us in 1980. I wanted to tell you also a little bit about some new literatures coming out from GSO, because one of the major things that we do there is through the literature committees of both the conference and the General Service Board, we publish all of the conference-approved AA literature. Now, Questions and Answers on Sponsorship has been rewritten with a new cover, and it will be available in September of 1976. It was reviewed by the Literature Committee, and they felt updated in terms of today's AA. There's a new booklet coming out that's very similar in size and scope to the Came to Believe in Living Sober. It's entitled, Do You Think You're Different? And this book was published because we found that so many people with particular interests were saying, why don't you have literature for the older AA member, for the younger AA member, for the man, for the woman, for the homosexual, for the black, for the Indian. And so we're trying to cover it all in this book. Also, bringing into focus the fact that there's room in AA for everyone. There's another pamphlet coming out that really was written to replace The Alcoholic Wife and The Alcoholic Husband. It will be ready in October of 76 also. It's called Is There an Alcoholic in Your Life? And that's an excellent pamphlet that I'm sure you're going to want to see. At our meeting this morning, our little workshop, somebody said that he moved here from Florida, and he said that he missed seeing the steps and the traditions on the wall in his meeting room. Well, GSO is now publishing, I don't know if any of you have seen them, but they're wall hangings with the 12 steps and the 12 traditions printed on them, and you hang them on a wall. It's a large size. See if it says how big it is here. Two wall hangers. No, it doesn't say how big they are, but they're big, and you can read them from the back of the room. They fold up and can be carried like a portfolio and stashed away very well. And you can get them for $25 each or a set in one box for $40. Also, we've printed in... on parchment, Dr. Bob's Farewell Talk, which is a companion piece to Bill's last message, and you can get the set for $250 or $150 each. The third edition of the big book is now out, and the new price, effective September 15, 1976, is $565. Group price is $515. So that's news. We raised the price of the big book, and the finance committee didn't think that was too good, and they thought it was a little too high, so we brought it back down. With the admonition that the base of group support of General Service is broadened. It was the feeling of the finance committee that we were relying too heavily on profits from literature to run our General Service office. Now, I understand from Rita that you people are particularly interested in the concept of regional forums, originally called regional mini-conferences. And I'd like to give you just a little background on that this afternoon. At the 1975 General Service Conference, Dr. Norris presented the concept of regional mini-conferences to the delegates. And it was their recommendation that this idea should be further explored and developed. Soon after the conference, preliminary planning meetings were begun at the office, and during the convention in Denver, that was July of 75, meetings were held with a delegates committee, which was chosen by lot, one from each region, and with the regional trustees to share ideas. It was the consensus of both of those groups that regional mini-conferences should begin on an experimental basis. And that was done prior to the 1976 conference. There was one held in December of 1975 in the Southeast region, and one in March of 1976 in the West Central region. Now, both of these were met with great success. The report that Dave Cook from the Southeast region gave read, the first regional mini-conference held in the Southeast in Atlanta was considered highly successful by all of the participants, including the General Service staff. Free, open, and honest discussion took place at all sessions. The members of the board and staff felt that the additional exposure to grassroots AA thinking and questions were both enlightening and valuable. And the AA service workers agreed that their problems and questions had been heard. Now, the reason for this is that, you know, traditionally the trustees and your delegates have always come to the board in New York. And we're trying to reverse this procedure so that the staff and the board can know what's happening with you. It's been very positive. After our 1976 conference approved that we go on with this idea, they've scheduled now another forum in Western Canada, which will take place next weekend. In March of 77, the Northeast region will hold one, probably in Boston. And in May of 1977, your region will have one of these mini conferences. 6 to 10 people, probably 2 to 4 trustees, regional, general service trustees, or general service, by general service, I mean the New York trustees, the 2 from the Grapevine, 2 from AAWS board, or your U.S. trustee or Canada trustee. But the important thing for you to know about this is that your delegates are the ones who make the choices about who comes. In other words, if you have, for example, Western Canada had a particular interest in the Grapevine. So they're great for their having Grapevine trustee attend. Whatever's on your mind, you let us know through your delegate and through Bruce White, who is your general service trustee. And he, working with Carl Louise at the office, will design your agenda for that meeting. The agendas have traditionally been kind of loose because they wanted to leave a lot of time open for people to get up and air their feelings and their angers and dissatisfactions with the office and the board, if that's necessary. And it really has been a very healing process. And I think that all of you are going to get a lot out of it. I know that the people who are in this room today are people who are really committed and interested in service. And I certainly hope that all of you will attend when you have your regional forum in May. Now, so much for the office and business. I'd like to tell you how I got to be an alcoholic in the first place. I was about 9 years old. I qualified because I came from an Irish Catholic family. A Bronx Irish Catholic family, and that's even worse than run-of-the-mill Irish Catholic family. And my mother had a terrible fear of alcohol. My father's father had died of alcoholism in Bellevue Hospital before AA came into being. And my mother knew about this and was afraid. Her own father drank 3 shots of Park and Tilford in the closet every morning when he came home from work. He was a night worker. And sometimes he got a little hostile in the morning. And she was very afraid of alcohol, so when I was 9 years old, she forbade me to drink. Now, I hadn't thought of it yet, but as soon as it was forbidden, I thought it was a pretty good idea. And I've always said that I sort of contained myself until I was 14 years old and I had the first drink. And I liked everything about it. I liked the way it tasted. I liked the way it smelled. And most of all, I liked what it did for me. I graduated from grammar school almost as tall as I am now. I think I might have gained an inch after that. And it made me feel shorter, and it made me feel prettier, and it made me feel more eloquent. And I thought it was the elixir of the gods. I thought it was marvelous. And not only all of that, it was forbidden. I lived, as most Irish Catholics do, in a matriarchal home. My mother was the dominant factor in our home. As a result, I didn't drink a great deal in my teens, but I drank as much as I could get away with. I went to work in New York City. I was brought up in a suburb of New York. And I went to work there when I was 16 years old, right after high school. And I quickly found out about the lunchtime cocktail, and I liked that. And as the years passed, I learned about the bars in the city, and I liked that. And I liked to sit at the bar. I was not a kitchen wino. I was a barroom drinker. And I like to sit at the bar, and I like the man with the big white apron and the mirror and the whole thing. I liked everything that went with it, so to speak. I felt at ease when I was drinking, and I did not feel at ease when I was not drinking. So right from the very beginning, alcohol was more than a beverage to me. I've often said I was an in order to drinker. I drank in order to do things, in order to go to the party, in order to talk to the boys. And as the years passed, and in the years immediately preceding my entrance into AA, alcohol had such a grip on me that I drank in order to go to the store. I drank in order to do almost anything that I had to do. I continued living at home and working in New York City, and when I was about 22 years old, I went away on vacation to the Pocono Mountains. You're not so far away from Pennsylvania that you don't know about the Pocono Mountains. And that's where all good secretaries go, you know, when they to operate, as we used to say in those days, on vacation. And by the time I was 22, I could hold my liquor. That was another, to me, signpost along the road of my drinking. I could drink more than anybody else and not show it. I didn't get sick. I held the heads over the toilet bowls. I drove the cars home. And I seemed to have this enormous capacity for alcohol. And so I had a marvelous time this week. Did a great deal of drinking. You know, drank milk before I went out because it lined your stomach. And had a marvelous time. And I met a gal there. She was from the Bronx, as a matter of fact. And she saw that I liked to drink. And she worked in the same building I did in New York. So she said, when we get back, there's a bar on 44th Street I think you might like. We'll get together and go there. And so we did. And I liked the bar all right. I liked it so much that 7 years later I was getting mail there and telephone calls there. And usually there was a hat or a pair of shoes hanging around that I had left from the night before or the night before that. Now, there was also the life at home, you know. I always had... I liked organizations. It's no accident that I ended up working at GSO because I always related to the organization. And I joined the Junior Women's Club, you know, before I found that bar and got to be president of it. But the trouble was I got drunk at the Junior Women's Club ball, you know, and then I got to be president. And with the president getting drunk, it wasn't too nice, you know, because they put pictures in the paper and the flowers were wilting. And, you know, the language, I get the barroom language mixed up with the Junior Women's Club language. And then that would be crooked. Finally, in my late 20s, I was 27 years old when I ran away from home, I always say. My mother and father were getting very upset with my behavior. And in the town that we lived, in the suburb of New York, the policemen would meet the trains, the late trains at night. If there was a woman walking alone, they'd follow her until she got home. It's the kind of small-town police protection you get. They got so tired of following me that they started driving me home in the patrol car. And my parents did not like that. And so my father came in and spoke to me and said, if you don't want to live by the rules and regulations of this household, perhaps you should live someplace else. And so I ran away from home. Moved into the city. And shortly prior to this point, I started having trouble with my nerves. I was suffering anxiety. I got a terrible claustrophobia attack on a Fifth Avenue bus one day. And it didn't go away when I got off the bus, and I went home and went to the doctor, and he said, hold out your hand, and he was shaking. And he prescribed some pills for me. They were called Desbutol, and this was in the early 1950s, I think, or middle. Desbutol had some dexedrine in it that pet you up and some butol in it that calmed you down simultaneously. And the effect was you could cross Fifth Avenue at 42nd Street against the light and not worry. I shook and I didn't care when I took Desbutol, and I took it for years, until the last few years of my drinking, and I just couldn't take it anymore. My nervous system was so destroyed that the up portion of it sort of sent me into outer space, and then I switched over to the more tranquilizing drugs. But I mixed all of these things with alcohol, and I consider myself a very fortunate woman today to be alive, because many, many people have died from what's called potentiation, which is the combination of drugs and alcohol, and when you combine the two, the effects are multiplied rather than adding the effects of the two together. At any rate, I left home, and at first the nervous system seemed better. You know, I figured my problems were all my mother and her mid-Victorian ideas. And I moved in with this girl called Ethel, and I used to say of Ethel, she only had two kind of topics of conversation. She was a Jewish girl from Waterbury, and Ethel liked to talk about how to get a rich Jewish husband, and she also dated interns from Bellevue, and so she knew a lot about disease, and she was always talking about disease. So in retrospect, I've observed of Ethel, she got the rich Jewish husband, and I got the disease. Anyhow, Ethel was fascinated by my activities up to a point, because the first week or two, I was fascinated with my own apartment, and I was there a lot, and she used to say she has an egg every morning and a beer every night. But pretty soon, that got boring, and I was back at the bar every night. And I lived 10, 12 different places before I came to AA. Getting along with people was difficult for me, more and more and more. I had one friend who's dead now. She was an artist, and she, a lot of them, after I left New York City, had lost track of me and my old drinking friends, and they worried about me, and she found me after I'd been sober about 6 months, and we saw each other some, and she was impressed with the program. She said, if I were ever to paint a picture of you, I would have drawn a great, big, crying baby. Because that's the way I was. I was a totally immature person, and I had my thumb in my mouth a lot. I was also very hostile. I had an awful lot of anger in me, but I didn't realize it was anger. I was out of touch with myself. I suffered enormously from anxiety and from fear. And I'd go to therapists. I went to a therapist for a year and a half. I was making $85 a week. I was going three times a week, and he charged $25 an hour. You know, it's ridiculous. So pretty soon, of course, that ended because I didn't pay him, for one thing, you know. And it wasn't working for me because I couldn't be honest with myself. I was totally out of touch with myself. I was a self-alienated person. I had no way to live. I had no guidelines for living. The therapy did not help me at all prior to AA. I have, however, in my sober life, returned to therapy and had off and on about 10 years of psychotherapy, which has helped me tremendously. For me, it was very important not to get my therapy mixed up with my AA and not get my AA mixed up with my therapy, because that would be a way to dilute the effects of either or both. When I was early sober, I was still extremely hostile. And when I went into this therapist's office, I sat down and I said, I want you to get one thing straight. I was sober now more than a year. And my sponsor had said, don't make any major decisions for a year, and that's a major decision. So I didn't. So I had my feet firmly planted in AA when I went to the therapist, and I said, now look, I've got this drinking lick, and I want you to mess with it, you see. You can take care of the rest of the stuff, all right, but I've got this lick. And he often laughed about it because I walked in his office and laid down a lot of rules and regulations as to how he was supposed to run this therapy, you see. But we worked together for several years, and it was enormously helpful to me, and he got to know a little about AA, and he felt that that was helpful to him. And that's just my experience with it. However, life went on for me. I started losing jobs. I lost seven of them. I left home in 57, I guess it was, 1960. I had to return home. My mother was terminally ill, and I grabbed that opportunity to return home without admitting that I was defeated, because I was indeed defeated. When I returned home, the gas and electric was turned off in my apartment earlier than a week or two before I moved out. And it wasn't because the gas company had the wrong date about my moving. It was because the bill wasn't paid. The telephone was out, and I was badly in debt. I did go home and take care of my mother until her death, and then I stayed on and kept house for my father. And my father was a very passive man. He was a very bright man. I really, really loved him very much. And yet I later learned I had enormous anger at him because he never did very much. And after my mother died, he never drank to any extent in my childhood, but after my mother died, I started the business of cocktails before dinner, and he enjoyed it. And he drank, in the end, in 16 months, he was up to a fifth a day when he was put into a rest home. The rest of the family was worried about the kind of care he was getting, but we weren't worried because we were both drunk most of the time. During this period of time, I ultimately got a job on Long Island. I started driving again, and I had some very serious automobile accidents. One of them, I destroyed two cars, and the other one was parked. And the newspaper report of that accident, I wish I could remember it because it was very embarrassing to my family. You know, Miss Little struck a car facing east while driving west or something like that. However they put it, it was very evident that it was on the other side of the street, you know, than the side I was supposed to be driving on. The doctor admonished me at that time. He tried to tell me in a very subtle way that drinking was my problem. I told you I lost 7 jobs, but nobody ever said to me, we're firing you because you're alcoholic or because you drink too much. And this was in the 1950s. I had one job with one of the major news magazines in the country. And they told me the day they fired me that I had been considered for secretary to the chairman of the board. And that was a big job. I didn't have an education, and that would have been making it in the secretarial field for me. And I was just about 30 years old. And they said, you were considered, but I not only didn't get that promotion, I got the pink slip. And I stayed drunk for a week, and my friends tried to help me, but all my friends were drinkers, so how'd they help me? They kept buying me drinks, you know. The fears grew and grew, and I got into the chemistry business of trying to find the pill that would calm me down. And my life was just chaos and disaster. I started with the jobs on Long Island, as I say, when I was keeping house for my father. And then I felt like the martyr of all times, you see. And I would tell everybody I had left this great career in New York City, when in fact I'd been thrown out, you know. I joined the bowling league, and they gave me a trophy at the bowling dinner for the person who drank the most. The bowling league, you know, it was a big joke. I suffered blackouts a great deal during this period. I was not able to express anger unless I was in a blackout. And unbeknownst to me, the few friends I had left, I would call up in the middle of the night and blast them out. And it was a very important thing for me to learn in the therapy when I was sober, that I have to learn to express my anger. And I'm not trying to make a case for anger, but I'm trying to make a case against resentment. If I don't like what you do, I don't have to hit you, but I have to communicate to you that it's making me unhappy. That does not make you have to do it my way, but at least you know. At least you know. And that, for me, is sometimes the most difficult thing, to say what I feel. Tell them how you feel should be another slogan, as far as I'm concerned. And of course, when we do this, and I've had some marvelous experiences in my time at GSO, with one of the Chicago delegates, and he came on very strong, but there was a marvelous thing about him. He let me come on strong, too. And we met in the middle, and good things came out of it. And it's positive to tell people how you feel, and I couldn't do that. And the rage was building up in me, the rage at my father, because I had to do everything. And of course I did damn little. And so it went on. My father finally had to be put in a rest home. I had gained 70 pounds in the last 7 years of my drinking. I was a sight to behold, if you want to know the truth. I had 2 dirty black dresses. I had matty hair. It hadn't been washed in weeks. A blotchy face. And I weighed about 235. I had a job, I got a job on Long Island. I was in this furnished room in Massapequa. I'll try and get to the point because I'd like to tell you some of the way I use the program. In October of 1962, I was in a furnished room in Massapequa. My father was in the rest home, my mother was dead. I had conned my father into signing, he was senile, and I conned him into signing papers for a passbook loan on his bank account. And that's easy to do if you have enough to drink, because I couldn't pay the rent. And then when I got the money, I paid 1 month's rent, and I went on a roaring drunk in New York with a guy that's dead now. and the checks that I wrote on that trunk were returned for a legible signature. I don't know if any of you have had that experience. But at any rate, in October of 1973, I didn't have a job. I do temporary work to get a little money here and a little money there, and I couldn't get a job. I was unemployable. And I had a broken down car that was in an equal state of disrepair as I was. And I started that car by spraying ether on the carburetor in July. And I stood up one morning, and I remember, Iris is here tonight, I remember hearing Iris say one night about the first honest prayer she ever said in her life, and as I recall her talking about it, she felt that she got some of her answers that brought her to AA, and I identified with what she said. Because I remembered, when I heard her say that, standing up in that room in October of 62 in the furnished room and saying simply, my God, get me out of here. And I meant out of the life, out of, I had no way to live. I was terrified, I was angry, I was a mess. And on that day, I picked up the paper, answered an ad, and on that day, I got a job over in Huntington, Long Island. That's the North Shore, in a little photo-optical company. Now, in order to go on the interview, I had a triple vodka Miltini, that's 3 Miltown, 3 shots of vodka, and a touch of a mousse. And that made me just about able to get my act together and start that car and go over to Huntington. I had on a cashmere coat that I had worn in better days in a women's ad club ball, and it was over a dress that had, I believe, a cigarette hole. The choice of the dresses was, do you wear the one with the split seams or the cigarette holes, you know. And so I couldn't take the coat off. It was in October, and the sun was coming through the glass of the building. And I sat in the reception room and waited 1 hour for the interview. And I almost ran, really. Because a guy, right before I went out, a guy I knew called me and asked me to go out for a drink at 5 o'clock. And I figured he was a much better bet than this interview. And I wasn't getting so many calls like that at that point in my life either. So, anyhow, I sat for an hour, and the sweat poured out of my eyes and the anxiety in my eyes. I can get on the subway today and spot an alcoholic woman. She's got runs in her stockings. Her heels need lifts, and she's got this awful look in her eyes, you know. The receptionist in that room where I sat for an hour was 2 months sober in AA, and by God's grace, I got the job and became friends with her. And for several months, I was not a pigeon in AA yet, but I was a sitting duck, because Dorothy was, she was going to get me. She'd go home to her husband and say, Bill, what if they fire her before I get her? And I would call in drunk. Now, I moved over to a little attic apartment in Huntington, and my life was the apartment, the grocery store, the liquor store, and the job, and moving that damn car, you know? And the drinking would get out of hand, and I wouldn't wake up in the morning, or once in a while when I went out, where there was a lot of liquor served and I didn't have to pay for it, I sometimes couldn't come in for 2 days. And I'd call in drunk the next morning, and Dorothy would say, hang up, I'm not putting you through. And she'd wait, my boss was on the phone, and when he'd hang up, she'd ring right in and say, oh, while you're on the phone, Betty called, terribly sick, you know. And she covered for me. And finally, in their own way, they invited me to attend a meeting of AA in Manhasset in April of 1963. And I accepted their invitation. Now, Manhasset, Long Island is, well, I don't know what the equivalent in Cleveland is, but it's a silk stocking group. It's a very high-income area, and the ladies wear mink stoles in the springtime, and they have alligator shoes with pocketbooks that match, you know. And in 1963, I thought that was the living in. And here she brought this 235-pound apparition into the Manhasset group on Thursday night. And a very, very cultured lady who came from old money. I mean, she was from the Gold Coast, North Shore, Long Island family. A lovely person. She came up to me and she said, my dear, are you a new member? And I looked down my nose at her and I said, I'm considering. And she said, well, that's wonderful, my dear. Won't you step up front? We have a special row for considerers. So I sat in the considerers row, and as luck would have it, there was two people from Manhattan. You see, Long Island, they're mostly what I've always called the kitchen wino ladies, you see, who always drank wine in their kitchen, with whom I would not have identified because I drank in bars. But that night they had speakers from New York City, and here was a single lady with a businesswoman story. And I'm here to tell you she looked nice. She looked nice. She looked like somebody you'd want to know. And she told her story, and she told about going to the liquor store and walking up and down in front of the wine rack trying to find the cheapest bottle of wine with the highest alcohol content. And I want you to know that's high mathematics for an alcoholic. And when you need that drink. And then picking it out and going to the counter and saying to the man, is this the right wine with chicken? Now, I had done exactly that the week before I went to the meeting, the night before payday. The same thing I said to the guy, is this the right wine with chicken? And so for the first time in my life, I identified. And something else happened. I wanted to be like her. She was a nice-looking lady. And a third thing happened to me that night in Manhasset. In spite of how I looked, and in spite of my hostility, they invited me back. And I had not been invited back anywhere in a long, long time, I'm here to tell you. My old friends liked me, but my God, it was bad news. And so they invited me back. They said, please come back on Monday. And I went home, and I went into that attic apartment now I had moved to in Huntington, and I stayed there all weekend. I didn't drink on Friday. The bill collector called on Friday. Yeah, I didn't intend to stop drinking. I was going to drink when I got paid on Friday, but the bill collector called, and I would have been out of work if I didn't send him the whole pay. And I went home, and I stayed in the apartment over the weekend, and Sunday I thought I got to do something. And I called Intergroup New York, and I asked them to send someone to take me to a Huntington meeting. And they did that, and it began a marvelous, marvelous life for me. I mean, I was talking to Jack at lunchtime. AA has given me everything I am and everything I have that's positive or good. It's given me a way to live. It's given me a capacity to love. I had no capacity to love. It's given me, through the 11th step, an understanding of the meaning of life for me. It's given me a relationship with my higher power. It's given me friendship and love with people now that I've known for many years. I learned how to be a friend in AA, and I learned how to accept friendship in AA. I find that life today, and ever since I have been in AA, it's been through many, many phases. Just like anybody's life is going to be if you live 13 years, a lot of different things are going to happen. When you're drinking, you know, nothing much happens. You fall off the bar stool or the other guy falls off the bar stool. I mean, what's the difference, you know? In AA, I've had my ups and I've had my downs. But I have enjoyed every minute of it, and I have worked the steps. When I was sober 3 months, first we talked a lot about the slogans, and I, one of my fondest AA memories, I had my first new pair of shoes, and I was driving that car, still spraying the ether on the covered, going over to Plainview to apply for a better job. And I remembered what they said at the meeting, you know, be with what you're doing now, and they explained projection. And it was in October, so it must have been 4 months. It was in October, and the leaves out there in Long Island were turning. It was a gorgeous, crisp day. And I started getting all nervous about this job interview, and then I remembered what they said at the meeting. I said, I don't have to be there yet. That's 10 miles away. I can be right here with the new shoes, feel good on my feet, and the car is going today. And the leaves are beautiful, and the air is crisp. Now, I didn't get that job, but I was the happiest person that man ever interviewed in his whole life because I was at one with now, at one with what I'm doing. And I learned to do this in AA. I wish I could tell you that I never projected from that day forward, but I have. You know, I'm going to lose that Belgian in the subway, and I wake up in the middle of the night and say, well, Ireland never send their report, you know, and will Central America send that last bit of money they owe? And but you see, I don't stay with it when I start projecting today. I bring myself back because I have a program to work. I have a program to work. So after I learned about these slogans and everything, that my sponsor came around with the book, 12 and 12. She said, you got to start learning about the steps. And I was taught to learn the first three, to read the first three. And I was introduced to step meetings. I was told to read the step in the book before I went to the meeting and read it again when I come home. And they said, you'll find that somebody changed the print when it was on the shelf there while you were at the meeting. Which is true, because I looked at it through other people's eyes at the meeting, and I came home and I saw something else on the page. And that's still happening to me today, because I still do it. We have a group in Manhattan that meets at Mustard Seed where we read the whole chapter of the step before we start the discussion aloud. And I love those steps because they've given me my life. They've given me everything that's good in my life. I went through a period in 1970. Everything was really nice in my life, you know. I had alligator shoes. I had an apartment with wall-to-wall carpeting. And I had a good job in a neighboring community, and I was secretary to the president. And the bank manager stood up when I came in. I played bridge down at the local bridge club, and I thought it was hot stuff, if you want to know the truth. And then I fell in love. And that's a difficult time for all of us. However, it did not work out the way I had orchestrated it. And I found myself on Lexington Avenue in Manhattan in a smaller apartment without the job, not knowing the people. And I cried and I wailed and I screamed and I did a couple of things right, but not many. I didn't pick up the first drink. I kept going to meetings and I kept talking to people in AA. And they saved my life. They saved my life. And I was told that I had certainly done a lot of work on the steps, but I had missed the most important part of the program, which was developing my own relationship with my higher power. And I was literally, by the pain of the breakup of this relationship, forced to my knees. And I have, since that time, developed a relationship with God as I understand it. And I'm even developing a little trust in His will for me. You know, I take it back from time to time. But I do find that in the last month or so, when I start worrying about the World Service meeting, I say to myself, God's got it, and it's going to be fine. And I know it is, because when I thought my life was all over, and when I thought there was nothing, you know, I just couldn't understand why I was alive. I was sober, and that didn't seem too hot. Through prayer, through meditation, I got an entirely different view of life and a stronger grasp on my AA. And since God has been sailing my ship, it's really been gorgeous. It's really been gorgeous, and it's brought me here to you this afternoon. I talked some about the literature that we have in the office, and one of my favorite pamphlets is A Member's Eye View. And I don't know if you're familiar with it, but if you're not, I hope you read it. And I would like to close my talk today with the last few paragraphs from Member's Eye View, because to me it describes what happens in AA when the person comes to AA. It says, this coming Sunday, in the churches of many of us, there will be read the portion of the Gospel of Matthew, which recounts the time when John the Baptist was languishing in the prison of Herod. And hearing of the works of his cousin Jesus, he sent two of his disciples to say to him, art thou he who is to come, or shall we look for another? And Christ did as he so often did. He did not answer them directly, but wanted John to decide for himself. And so he said to his disciples, go and report to John what you have heard and what you have seen. The blind see, the lame walk, the lepers are cleansed, the deaf hear, the dead rise, the poor have the gospel preached to them. Back in my childhood catechism days, the author says, I was taught that the poor in this instance did not mean only the poor in a material sense, but also meant the poor in spirit, those who burned with an inner hunger and an inner thirst, and that the word gospel meant quite literally the good news. More than 16 years ago, four men, the author's boss, his physician, his pastor, and the one friend he had left, working singly and together, maneuvered him into AA. Tonight, he said, if they were to ask me, tell us, what did you find? I would say to them what I now say to you. I can tell you only what I have heard and seen. It seems the blind do see, the lame do walk, the lepers are cleansed, the deaf hear, the dead rise, and over again, in the middle of the longest day or the darkest night, the poor in spirit have the good news told to them. God grant that it may ever always be so. Thank you.
Well, that was fine, Betty. Thank you. Far be it from us here to start telling you how to run your personal life, but as the saying goes, kiddo, you probably ought not to drink anymore. I don't think from the way you describe it, I just don't believe you can handle it. But we do thank you for not only sharing with us, especially for sharing with us, but then the informational part about what you do and the General Service Office work. We're going to take a short break now, and then we'll come back to Bob's report on the workshop and our other speakers, so we'll break now. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
First time I ever heard the full
thing. Oh, that's good. Okay, Jack.
I'm afraid so.
Yeah.